Here in the Zenda?
Yeah, that place. I started grabbing that when I was driving in.
Can you hand me that little bag that has my glasses in it? Otherwise, I can't see names. Thank you very much. So, welcome everybody. It's good to see you all. It's good to see everybody in the Zendo. What we're going to do now is I'm going to introduce the people online, and we will bow as we introduce each other, and then we'll go to the people in the Zendo. Betty. Betty. Mark.
Mark.
Mark. Paulette.
Paulette.
Paulette. Karen.
Karen.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Paola.
Paola.
Brian.
Brian.
Coral.
Coral.
Christina.
Christina.
Melissa.
Melissa.
Jim.
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 Bob.
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 Camille.
Camille.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Mick.
Sideways Mick.
Soon.
Soon.
Ruth Ann.
Ruth Ann.
Katie.
Katie.
Joey.
Joey.
Dave.
Dave. Dave.
James.
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 So, welcome to everybody. Thanks for being here. Just two very quick announcements. We had an absolutely wonderful picnic last night. It was a beautiful evening. Thank you to all who were there. All the dogs had a great time once they got used to each other. And the only other announcement is that we have open mic night coming up on Saturday, August the 6th. And that is from 5 until 7. We've never done an open mic night before, so maybe one of us can, maybe I'll get in touch with Domio or Summer. Did they talk about it on the board meeting?
Yeah.
So what is it?
Well, it's basically any particular talent or lack of talent around anything that you enjoy doing that you would like to share. We're actually not calling it an open mic night specifically because people hear open mic and they're like, ah, I can't do my thing. And it's it really isn't like that, like I'm trying to be on stage and show off and all that. It's mostly just around sharing. So we're calling it sharing in Sangha so that we can just, you know, we see each other on Zoom or here in the Zendo and we don't know necessarily what everybody likes to do that's not directly related to our practice here that may be related to practice or not. So if we're, you know, you're an amateur musician or a poet or storyteller or just about anything really is up for the event. And so I've got I think Domio in the last message may have included a link to the sign up sheet. So if you're interested, go ahead and sign, put your name down. I'm the organizer of it, so obviously. So feel free to reach out to me directly. My email address is there in the instructions as well, and I'll be happy to clarify. But just really anything that you want to share. I know Domio plans to play accordion. I'll probably end up playing something. If anybody, again, if you have any piece of poetry that you'd like, and it doesn't have to be original. It could be some stuff you'd like to read, something that resonates with you that you'd like to share with your fellow Sangha members.
And this is an event that's really for Dirt Zendo plus Cloud Zendo. Yeah. So we do hope a lot of people attend.
We will be alternating. During the event, we'll have somebody in the Dirt Zendo, then have somebody in the Cloud, and somebody in the Dirt, somebody in the Cloud. So it'll be
inclusive. That is all I have to say. So we are now on our second Sangha Voices talk, and James is up as soon as I can get out of this seat.
Hello. Hello. All right, let me get situated here. sprained my ankle last week, so trying to do all of this without hurting it too much more. So, good morning. I think I know everybody here, and one, maybe not. I've seen you virtually or otherwise. Today, I want to give the original idea behind all of this was to give a way-seeking mind talk, which in the Zen tradition is a very common thing, where a practitioner in the Sangha talks about the way that they came to practice. And so mine is going to be that, but it's going to be maybe a little bit more than that, too. And so what I'd like to do today is talk about giving up, which if you read the write-up in the newsletter, we often have a negative connotation around this term giving up. You know, we relate the term to people who are just like abandoning a project. Oh, never mind. I'll never get it done anyway. I'm not good enough. I can't do this. And it becomes this negative type of abandonment, laziness, apathy. There's all these terms around this phrase giving up. But what if it was a good thing? What if there was a degree to which giving up was the healthiest and most wholesome thing that we could do and most helpful thing we could do? And this is a concept that is not foreign to us. If we've been in the Zen tradition for any length of time, we also call it things like letting go, opening the hand of thought, dropping off. You know, there's all these other terms that we use. But I like giving up because for reasons that I'm going to get into in my discussion today. So I'll talk for a fairly short amount of time. I'm going to do the really unusual thing and stick to my notes, which I really hate to do. I'm a jazz musician, man. We improvise, you know. That's what I usually do. So I'm going to try to actually adhere to my notes today. I'm going to briefly summarize 30 years of life as succinctly as humanly possible. For me, from about ages 16 to 46 is really the period of time where I realized my life was very much focused around one particular disease. That's a bad word for it. But the thing that was causing me the most suffering, let's put it that way. And that was ego identity. And, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, we say, well, ego identity is at the root of all suffering. Everybody's ego identity, this idea that we are separate from others, that we're an individual self, that we have, there's this inherent self here, and it's bumping up against, rubbing up against everybody else's selves, you know. We use that term for that. But I actually mean it in the more elementary form of the phrase ego and identity, where I spent the vast majority of those 30 years trying to be somebody, trying to make something of myself, become, create, make someone out of myself. And so I was really focused on cultivating my character, my personality, my look, my style, my everything under the sun. And so what that really meant was I was very much an extrovert, and I have watched that extroversion slowly diminish over the period of my practice to where now I have a much more of a focus on introversion. And what's funny is many years ago in my day job, I took the Myers-Briggs personality assessment. I don't know if anybody in the corporate world has ever done this, but they rate, you know, you get a four-letter, you know, ESTJ, EN, something, so I even forget all of them. And I was like, and what was really odd to me was I took the test and it said my extroversion-introversion was dead center. That I was like half and half. And I was surprised at the time. I was like, what? Introversion? I'm not an introvert in any way, shape, or form. I am 100% extrovert. Now I'm starting to see that introversion come to light. So I was very extroverted, very much out there. Like my personality, myself, you know, really existed like 1 or 2 feet out in front of me at all times. It really was about constantly interacting with the world around me to get the validation, to get the approval, to get the attention that I really wanted, because I didn't really know who this was inside. Who is James? James doesn't know who James is. James relies on other people to tell him who James is. I wish I had this, you know, clarity and cognizance 30 years ago. My life probably would have been much different. But it was very exhausting, as you can probably imagine. way of being, just always being out in front. So it was a lot of smoke and mirrors. You know, it was like a Halloween costume of sorts. That, you know, I'm wearing this Halloween costume named James M. Gregg, and James M. Gregg is a, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and all these different personalities and hats I was wearing at any given time to try to get the feedback, you know. And in my particular case, that ego identity really manifested itself quite well. It could have come out in any way, right? We all know these people probably in some facet of our lives that's, you know, really outgoing and personable and seems to just do everything and seems to be good at everything and is just always on, you know. Those types of people are probably pretty exhausting for a lot of folks. And I prided myself on being one of those people. But it could manifest in any way. You know, I've known people who were, you know, corporate managers or real estate agents or, you know, athletic coaches or whatever, and that's how they manifested that part of their personality, was just always being on in that mode. My particular mode was my career as a performing musician. That was my vehicle, the vehicle through which I could manifest my ego identity. So I needed to be on stage like almost all the time. And I mean literally on stage, like literally on a stage under the lights with the whole thing, but also just in any kind of one-on-one interaction, in personal interactions and in work interactions, there was kind of always this desire to be out there and to be, the words that I used to my wife once years ago, that I still, every time I think about this, I cringe, because she was rightfully, you know, having some concerns about the level of activity that I was, you know, out and about and all the time, and I was always just busy, 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 busy. And she expressed some concern about this, very rightfully so. And the exact words that I said to her were, well, this is just who I am. This is what I do. I have to stay out there to stay relevant. It makes me sick to my stomach just to even say it right now. But I basically admitted, you know, like, it's just really all about being out there and being the guy, being the man, you know. And so that need to be on stage manifested in a variety of ways, that it pretty much came down to this, like, I would try something, and if it worked, then I would keep doing that thing, but then I would usually double down or triple down on that thing and now start doing more of it, you know. If something didn't work, if I got negative feedback, then it was, I'm done with that, man. You know, it didn't have anything to do with how valid or valuable that project was or that concept was in and of itself, you know, how inherently useful or beneficial it was. If it didn't bring me the feedback I was looking for, if I got crickets, literally or figuratively, it was, God, I have no time for that. I'm abandoning that. And so in terms of what I was actually doing, in practical terms, you know, I literally would, I'm going to start a new band. You know, I've got this idea for this cool musical project. Okay. And I'm going to do this and that, and we're going to do these songs, and I would put it all together, and I get the musicians, and I book the show, and I get the songs, and I put everything together and play a show, you know. And if the show was packed, it was sold out, and people were like, yeah, that was awesome, amazing, woo, you know, you can bet I was going to hold on to that thing. Didn't really have to do with whether or not that's what I really wanted to be doing, or was that the what really needed to be out there? It didn't have anything to do with that. It had everything to do with that immediate validation. And if I got nothing, you know, there was no crowd, there was, you know, people were kind of apathetic about it, didn't care, you know, didn't want to, then it was done for. Even if it was really valuable, creative, inventive, didn't matter. I'm done with that. So as you can imagine, all this activity of trying something, getting positive feedback, doing more of it, it eventually turns into this whirlwind of activity. And I was, you know, a literal whirling dervish for quite a few years. Because in addition to all this, I was trying to balance not only the career, but I also relationship, you know, and a day job. Because I've always at least been practical enough to know I shouldn't try to make a living doing this, which was good, because the amount of times that I picked up new things and abandoned others and all that, I would have never, you know, I would have never made any money doing it, any substantial amount of money at least. And so this manifested itself not only in terms like of like the projects I was involved in and the people I was interacting with, but even down to things like my look and my personality. Like I was always trying to cultivate this smooth, charismatic, funny, charming, like I was always working on that part subconsciously. I never thought to myself, looking in the mirror, okay, James, your charisma's lacking a little bit. Let's work on that. You know, it was never quite that at the forefront of my mind, but it was always there as a subcurrent. And, you know, my look. And I can look back now and I can say my physical appearance had everything to do with, like when I was playing rock and funk, I had one look. But when I started doing big band music, I adopted a completely different look, you know. Like in the rock and funk, I had the crazy hair, you know, all spiked and dyed, and I had multiple earrings, and I was all brooding, and, you know. But when I started doing the big band and directing, you know, we were doing all the Frank Sinatra, Bobby Darin stuff, now I had the big pompadour with the shirt on the sides, and I was always wearing vests and ties, and, you know, like I was 1947 all over again or something crazy like that. So this was my life, 30 years or so of this type of constant behavior. And you can imagine that, you know, sometimes it works and a lot of times it didn't, especially when it came to my personal relationships, like this level of activity and just living the lifestyle of a little rock star, even though I wasn't always rock music. But just kind of, you know, being out there and in that dynamic, it destroyed, you know, at least a couple of relationships that I'd had too. And I lost a lot of friends, and I lost a lot of opportunities, and there was just a lot of damage done in that 30-year period of time. Finally, in October of 2015, I remember the day, I had a sudden and shocking realization. I was just coming off of a big personal crisis that centered around all of this, too, just a couple of months prior. And so now I was in this kind of vulnerable period of quiet and self-reflection, and I had this sudden, in October 2015, had this sudden shocking realization that it was all a sham. Basically, everything I've admitted to you just now, for 30 years, I didn't think of it that way. You know? I was like, I'm a musician. This is what I do, right? I play shows. I play in other people's bands. And I did a lot of really cool stuff. You know, I played for 10 people. I played for 10,000 people. I played on movie soundtracks and TV soundtracks, and I put out my own albums, and I play just all sorts of really cool. I played the Hollywood Bowl, you know, like this. There's been some really cool stuff that's happened, and I don't regret it. But I realized in October of 2015 that the reason I was doing it was not the right reason. I had a lot of musician friends, and still do, that they're in it for the artistry. This is my creative outlet. This is my muse. This is my passion. This is what I do, like from here, from my heart. You know, this is the only thing I could do. You know? And there are stories of musicians throughout history that, like, you know, John Coltrane, for instance, the great jazz saxophonist. Like, this is a cat who would play, he would practice 12 hours a day. You know, and then he'd do drugs and get drunk. But, you know. But he practiced and practiced and practiced, and he was constantly, and you can even hear it in his recordings, like, you could hear him, like, no, that was not right, I've got to do it again, and keep playing the same thing over and over until he got it right. Like, it was just, there was a level at which that was the only thing he could do, really, you know. And I realized in that October 2015 that that's not where my career was coming from. That's not where my music was coming from or what I was trying to do. I probably had it in me, and I realized over the years since that I did have a different version of it in me that was more wholesome and much and more creative. But what I had been doing up to the point was almost entirely for the wrong reasons. And so I had an opportunity at that moment in time to give it up. And I did. I literally, in that month of October 2015, I abandoned almost every single thing that I was doing. I quit everything. I disbanded any group I was the leader of or stepped down. I called guys that I had been performing with regularly and saying, I am no longer available. I'm off the market. And I literally tanked my musical career almost overnight. And I can say that with a big smile on my face because it was the best decision I had ever made. After 30 years of just this immense amount of activity, and some of it really amazing, and some of it not so. I just tossed it all out the window. And again, it was the best thing I've ever done. Now, what's interesting is that this was all happening before I had even discovered Buddhism. I had no idea what Buddhism was about. So when I did discover Buddhism, completely through a separate situation, I've said it a couple times, I don't want to waste time here, but it was a funny little, it's a funny story, but I've told it before. But when I did discover Buddhism and I started practicing it, and I started, I've said this before to you, I started off in Theravada, Thai forest tradition. What was really interesting about it was that that tradition in particular is very much focused on renunciation, very much focused on the idea of giving up. If you're familiar with that, with the Theravadan tradition, especially Thai forest, there's much more of a focus on monasticism, and it's a very ascetic form of monasticism that's very much modeled after what they believe the original Buddhist Sangha lived like. So these are monks that, you know, they don't own any possessions, they have no job, they're celibate, they have no money, they're not allowed to handle money at all. The monks in that tradition, at least the one that I was in, they couldn't even touch money, let alone have a bank account. All of their meals were donated completely. Donated. They can't cultivate food. They couldn't grow food. They couldn't shop for food. They couldn't keep food in there, which was really funny because there's a hermitage out in the Columbia River Gorge in white salmon for the tradition that I was in. And there's usually two or three monks living there. And I visited out there a couple of times. And I walk into the place. It's beautiful. They have this nice, big, beautiful kitchen that they never use. It's kind of funny. The Sangha members who donate the food, of course, use it, but the monks themselves do not. So the large part of the day, the kitchen is just sitting there completely unused, and the refrigerator is always empty. You know, so it's kind of funny. But there's this real focus on renunciation of all of the things that we take for granted in our regular lives. You know, like I said, they don't keep food, they don't keep money, they don't drive, they don't do 90% of the things that you and I have to do to maintain our daily lives or are used to doing or like to do. You know, they don't listen to music or watch TV shows or movies or anything like that. It's nothing. It's pure renunciation. And so when I came across that tradition, and I had already abandoned my musical career, so I was already kind of on this track, it was very easy for me then to pick up some of that. And so I started practicing some of these ascetic practices myself. The first thing I did was the best decision I made was shave my head. So, I love it now. It's so low maintenance. It's perfect. Just get out the razor once. I toned down the wardrobe. You know, silly things like that. They seem silly, but it meant a lot to me in a previous life. And so the deliberate act of doing the opposite was very meaningful to me. But I even went to, like, I stopped watching TV or movies. And I went down to one meal a day that I ate before noon, just like the monks in that tradition did. And so it was this deliberate choice to adopt as much renunciation as I could, being married with a kid and a day job. You know, there was a degree of renunciation that I couldn't do. And I certainly wasn't going to ordain in that tradition. And so, you know, bye-bye. Lovely wife and child, and you know, I wasn't going to do that. So within the life that I wanted to continue living, which involved my family and my day job and whatnot, I tried to renounce as much as possible. And it reminded me of in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first discourse, the wheel turning discourse, where the Buddha said, hey, there are two, and he was, of course, talking to his five former counterparts who they had been living this very ascetic lifestyle together, not eating or eating one grain of rice, you know, and just sitting out in the baking sun for hours on end. And, you know, they were all shriveled skeletons of human beings. And the Buddha came and to them and said, you know, there's a middle path. We don't have to adopt the indulgent, luxurious lifestyle that he himself had known, as a young prince in the Shakya clan. But it also doesn't have to be this thing that we've been doing all these years of complete renunciation and asceticism and, you know, never lying down and standing on one foot and standing in the sun and not eating and all this. So we don't have to do that either. There's a middle path. And so I really chose this idea of, hey, you know, I've been indulgent all these years. Now, to come to the middle, to come to a sensible center, I have to give up. There's nothing I have to acquire in order to find a middle path. It's for me, and probably for a lot of us, it's going to be all about the giving up of the things that I don't need. I came across a quote recently that really, really summed this up for me from one of my absolute favorite teachers, the Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. She was giving a talk, this was actually back in 2015, she was giving a talk called Beyond Buddhism, What We Need to Lose to Save What We Love. It's on YouTube, and which is where I read it. And I think she was giving the talk at, it was around like Naropa University, Shambhala Center, or something like that. I couldn't actually figure out where she was, but she's giving this talk, and she said, and I quote, "Everything I have done that is of value has been because I have given something up. Everything that I have discovered that I truly love is because I gave up something that I was enamored with, that I had attached my identity, that I had attached my sense of comfort to." And so for me personally, this idea of giving up something that I was enamored with, for me was, I was enamored with myself. Or at least I was enamored with the person that I thought I needed to be. I was enamored with the James M. Gregg that was the star, that was the center of attention, that was well-dressed and charming and charismatic and funny and smooth and all these things that I thought I was, which is kind of embarrassing to even admit now, you know, that I tried to be all those things. And I think back all those years, how many people saw right through it? How many people looked at me and said, this guy is a complete poser. He's such a phony, you know. Probably more than a few. Some of them willing to tell me to my face, but I've forgotten all about them because they didn't fit into my equation, right? Oh, that's negative feedback. I'm going to just, you know, and I just forget about it because I don't want to hear it at that point in time. Now I would take it very seriously. You're kind of being a phony right now. Oh, really? Tell me more. I want to know more. But because I didn't want to hear it, you know, I discarded it. So for me, giving up really meant letting go of that ego identity, giving up this notion that I was defined by who I wanted to be, who others told me I should be, what society told me or whatever the culture I was in, you know, whatever that was telling me I needed to be and who I thought I needed to be, giving that up, giving up on the idea that my external self was going to somehow validate my internal self. And there's a degree to which, you know, you kind of fix the outside before you fix the inside, right? And you know, anybody who's struggled with addiction, this is one of the first things you do, right? So you stop going to bars, you stop going into the liquor store. That way I'm not tempted. So I'm fixing the outside so that I can fix the inside. But to what degree can I just discard that outside entirely and truly be this self that I don't even know who I am? And of course, through the practice, we learned that, well, that self isn't really there to begin with. It's all just cobbled together, a conglomeration of ideas and concepts and thoughts and cravings and aversions. One of my favorite cases from the Rinzai tradition that I've spoken specifically about this case in a previous talk was Kyogen's Man Up a Tree from the Mumenkon, case number 5 in that in the Gateless Gate collection. And if you don't know the koan, I'll summarize it briefly, but it's the, so what is it? It's as if a person is up a tree hanging on by a branch with their teeth. Their hands and legs can grasp nothing, flailing in air. Another person comes to the bottom of the tree and asks an important question. If the person hanging from the tree refuses to respond to the question, They have missed an extremely important opportunity. If, however, they open their mouth to answer, they fall to their death. And of course, all of this is very metaphorical. I had built a tree of my own ego delusion. Who am I? I am this branch here as this jazz trumpet player. Well, no, over here I'm a, you know, more Latin funk, and I change my look or I change my style, and I, you know, the charm and the smoothness and the look and the personality and the feel and all these branches of self that I had built, this what I thought was this beautiful tree. Beautiful, big, luxurious oak tree of self, you know, that really turned out to just be a little twig, that I climbed and climbed and tried, I explored all the branches, but eventually you can't sustain that. And I found myself hanging on by my teeth. And the important question that came from the bottom of the tree was, who are you really? Who do you want to be? What are you really doing? What impact are you having on the world around you and the ones that you love? And I couldn't answer that question the right way. I chose to cling to the branch by my teeth for a long time, even though that question came up many times. Is this who you really are? Is this who you really want to be? Do you really think you're doing any good? And I refused to answer and clung for my life to that branch until 2015, 2016, I finally decided to let go and die. Die to the old self. And now, in the practice, the common admonition to die on the cushion. Die to the self that you think you need to be or that you think you are. And open up to the self that you really are, which is the universe itself. All things, everywhere. So for me, this is the giving up part. Giving up, in this case, my own life, in quotes, not my actual physical body, you know, heart beating and brain function, but the life that I thought I needed to have, and the life that I wanted to have. Give it up. Give up that life so that I could find a real life. Not through rejection or aversion, of course, not treating it as if this is now some horrible thing that I need to throw in the trash, but to separate myself from it, to set it down. And when it comes up, and it still does, right? I mean, that's what the practice is about, the constant ebb and flow of the delusion piling back on, and then you have to put it back down, and then it comes back, and then you have to put it down again. There's a really good story in the Thai forest tradition about this, where the current leader of the Western Thai forest Sangha by the name of Ajahn Sumedho, he's got to be 90-something now, living in Thailand, but he's actually an American. He told a story about joining the monastery Wat Phapong in Thailand with Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest master, Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah sent him to a hut in the middle of nowhere and said, go meditate. You know, so Ajahn Sumedho goes out there, and somebody would bring him his meal, but he was completely alone and, you know, able to do his meditation and whatnot, his walking and sitting meditation pretty much all day. And he said after like a week, it was glorious. I was in heaven. I could feel the enlightenment, just all of the fetters coming off, and I just had this, I was finally achieving nirvana. And then I had to travel into Chiang Mai to get my visa renewed, and it all just went just out the window. Dealing with people, dealing with real life, dealing with the bureaucracy and this, all of these feelings of nirvana, these beautiful enlightenment feelings that he had had for this last week just completely went away, and he was right back to square one. So finding that middle path, how do we balance our everyday life with our practice? And how can we give up the things? How can we set down? How can we open the hand of thought? How can we drop off body mind? All these great metaphors we have in the Zen tradition that tell us to do this, that we have to continually remind ourselves about. It reminds me of when my son was an infant. And he would cry in the middle of the night. Right? And for a while, every time he'd cry, my wife or I would run in there, pick him up, and soothe him, put him in the rocking chair, rock, and gently lay him back down. I hope he didn't wake up. Because if he did, okay, now I got to pick him up again. And this went on for months. It was like, oh my gosh, this is not working. So what did we have to do finally? He starts crying, just sit there, just lay there. And for a couple of agonizing days, he would just cry and cry and cry. But then after a few days, no more crying. By not picking him up, by not giving the attention, it stopped. And he learned that, oh, I don't need to cry. I can soothe myself back to sleep. This is great. Okay. And I think about our delusions and our everyday cravings and aversions like a crying baby, always crying for attention. Feed me, feed me, feed me. Love me, love me, love me. Hold me, hold me, hold me. And if we can just let them rest, give up our need to engage with them, that they will eventually quiet down. Not go away, but they'll at least quiet down. I think about it like even like a scales, like, here's enlightenment and equanimity and compassion and mudita, the equanimous joy, the sympathetic joy, and all these wonderful qualities of Brahma Viharas are on this one side of a scale, and all of our prejudice and our anger and our low self-esteem and our desires, around food and entertainment and all that, just all the stuff that we love that's not really important or good for us on the other side of the scale. And it's this constant practice of throwing these things off of the scale that's going to help us find that balance between the mind of enlightenment and the mind of delusion. And this is something that I came across with Heart Sutra, where some people are put off by all those negations. There's a lot of scholarship around this too. It's like, oh, it's all know this, know that, know the other thing. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no ignorance, no old age or death or lack of old age or death. There's all these negations. Like, why does it have to be so negative? Why does the Heart Sutra have to say no to everything? It has to say no to everything because we are conditioned to say yes to everything. Our whole lives are built around acquisition and affirmation. We need to hear this message that says no to all of that, so that we can throw those off that scale and find that balance. Give those things up so that we can find balance on our scales between the mind of delusion and the mind of enlightenment. So if everything of any value we've ever done is because we gave something up, is that true? I think about that sometimes. Is everything I've ever done of any value a result of something I gave up? Well, I have two wonderful children. What did I give up? Well, I gave up the life of not having children, which comes with, certain benefits. Even little things like, I'm going to sit down at the piano and just play some, I feel like playing some songs. And I'll sit down at the piano and I'll get 30 seconds in, and what happens? Here comes my 5-year-old daughter. Daddy! And she sits down on the piano bench and blam, 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 blam. Just little stuff like that. I'm giving up my desire to play my music so that my daughter can sit on my lap and plunk out keys. I'm giving something up. Is it a value? Yeah, I feel like it is. She gets some little music time. She's got interaction with me. Like, it's a thing of great beauty. So things that are really small like that, up to things that are huge, like giving up an entire 30-year career. Not that I don't do it anymore, but I found a way to do it in a way that is wholesome, in a way that isn't feeding ego delusion or isn't an example of me trying to get attention and yet still be creative and still do what I know best, even if it's not necessarily what I do best, which is music. So if everything of any value that we've ever done is because we gave something up, can we think about that and find those examples in our own lives where that's true? And what can we give up today? We leave here, Zoom call ends, we leave the Zendo here. What can we give up so that we can add value to our lives? Thank you. Oh, questions. Those of you here in the Zendo, if you have a question, if you would please, I'm not sure if that chair is actually in a good spot. Yeah, that's our little chair. And then for those of you in Zoom land, if you would go ahead and do the electronic hand raise, and I can call your name if you have any questions or comments. Bob. Hello, Bob. Good to see you, sir.
Thank you, James. So, what brought you to Zen? What brought you to Brightway?
Excellent question. Thank you. I actually, when I first discovered Buddhism purely by accident, I set out to study Buddhism as a kind of an intellectual exercise. And so I studied all the traditions on some level, literally everything, Tibetan, in the Japanese, like Nichiren and Tendai and everything, every tradition I studied on some level. And I actually had an early affinity for Zen, but I was balancing that study of the traditions with like the practical side of, I've got to find, if I really want to practice this, I've got to find a sangha, a local sangha that I can practice with. And it needs to be a tradition that I resonate with, like for me, my personality, that it kind of fits and it makes sense. And so for me personally, there was a degree of some of the Tibetan traditions that I just didn't, they didn't mesh with me. I'm sure they mesh with certain people, but for me, I couldn't handle all the complexity and all the, it seemed really complex. And for a newcomer, I didn't want that. So Zen appealed to me, but then, and I've told Domio this story, it's kind of a funny, kind of ridiculous too. I went to the Dharma Rain website, and I was looking at all the there's a very detailed explanation of the forms. And I was like, oh, all that walking in a straight line and bowing and knowing when to bow and all the chant, oh, I can't do that. So I said, Zen, maybe, we'll see. And then I discovered the local Thai forest. And the thing that struck me about that was, okay, they're trying to be as authentic to the original Buddhist Sangha as possible, maybe that's a good place to start. And so that's where I started in that tradition. But what was interesting is I gradually became a little bit disenchanted with the structure, with the heavy, heavy focus on this monastic community and everybody else. And no real overlap there. It felt a little artificial to me. I'm like, good for you, but I didn't really see how I fit into that as a lay practitioner. And I did their version of the Jukai, where I took the five precepts and the grave precepts and was an upasaka, they call it in that tradition. But after a while, I was just like, I don't know. And just by chance, there's a Rinzai Zen community that uses that same space, the Portland Friends of the Dhamma building over on Hawthorne. And Rinzan, Pachovnik Osho actually came to the Friends of the Dhamma and gave a talk. And he didn't adapt his talk to, I'm talking to a bunch of Thai forest practitioners, I should adapt my talk to, he didn't do that. He just did a straight up Zen talk. And he did a talk on the case one of the Mumonkan, the Joshu's Mu. Does a dog have the Buddha nature or not? Joshu said Mu. And I was just like, I was completely starstruck by it. I mean, he's got a really, he's got a lot of charisma and style, so that was kind of cool too. But just the talk, I was like, okay, this is, so I did actually practice there for a little while. But it's kind of a distance and the times weren't right. And I had actually looked at Brightway Zen during my initial explorations, and I can't remember why. So I looked into it again, and here I am. I said, I'm going to come back. And I remember my first day was a just sitting. I'm not sure Mark might have been there, but I know Bruce was there. And the first thing Bruce says to me, he sees me in my black t-shirt, and I got my tattoos and the whole thing. He's like, oh, are you, my shaved head. He's like, oh, are you one of those Zen guys? I was like, I hope God not. Not yet. So, it was kind of funny. So that's why I'm here. That's a long answer, but thanks, Bob. Lisa Son. Of all the people to understand what I was talking about today, I figured.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to a point, you know, hi, everybody. It's been a while. I have rehearsals. I am a full-time working musician and have been forever. And I used to have had rehearsals going on every Sunday. And so there's a 12-step meeting I was missing. And then I've been sick for a month and it's just a cold, but it's just, this is like the worst cold ever. But anyway, I mean, I relate to a lot of what you said kind of early in my career, and that real focus on the outward projection and being accepted, and you want to go to the jam and you want to show off and you want everybody to hear your chops and all that stuff. And now, I mean, but really, when you really are a full-time working musician, my job is to scrape pennies off as many tables as possible. And that's pretty much, if people ask me what I do, that's what I do. I scrape pennies off tables. And I can't, you know, I remember my teacher, Kyogen, and Kakumiya also talks about this physical feeling of tightness that you get around something. And the tightness that I used to get about like being looking cool and being cool and fitting in and things like that, I don't really fit. It's like, now it's like, I get through the set list and I find how much is the gas and they go, oh yeah, what am I going to wear? So, you know, that's kind of become, oh God, that's something I have to do now. But the tightness for me is around money, because like I just made a really big investment and now I'm doing this heavy metal thing and I've invested a lot of money in this project, and you can't like make people come to your show or buy tickets or buy your CD, and you can't make them do it. All you can do is go, here it is, you know, and all you can do is go to ASCAP and type your set list in, and all you can do is sign up for the Sound Exchange and all this little thing where you just get a little bit of money here and a little bit of money there. And, you know, so I'm definitely I'm sort of making a living at it, you know, but that for me, that's where the tightness is. And so that's something really worth exploring for me, is that, well, you know, in the other program that I'm in, you know, talk about fear of economic insecurity, leaving you. And I still have this fear of economic insecurity. But what I want to ask you as a question, I'm on Twitter a lot, and I found this metal Twitter community, and there's all these people, all these different ages. There's people that are my generation and there's younger people, and they chat a lot about music. There's a lot of musicians, and a lot of them talk about something called imposter syndrome. And I don't know if you've ever heard that term. So I don't really get it. And so I'm just wondering what does that, does that term resonate for you, or what does it mean to you? Because I see a lot of people talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, in relation to other people, I think for me, I've seen that term used for like, I'm trying to think of an actual artist, but some of these people that, you know, they get out there and they just seem like, you know, they're the king of the world, but then in their private life, they're really hurting, and they're really scared, and they're, you know, and I, obviously with celebrity, we, you know, a lot of people then turn to substance abuse or other types of abuse, self-harm, whatever, to try to mitigate that. And so I think that's a form of imposter syndrome. I'm pretending to be this really amazing person, but I really know deep down that I'm not. And so I identify with that to a certain degree. I certainly have never, you know, enjoyed the heights of the fame and success that some of the, you know, or the depths of self-loathing that some of those people that they might be referring to have experienced. But, you know, if some of the you know, like the Kurt Cobains of the world, or at least, you know, like here and here, you know, I think I was probably, you know, here, you know, like it was it, the my the distance between my quiet self and my loud self was somewhat dramatic, but it wasn't quite that dramatic to where, especially I wasn't, you know, swirling down into depths of despair and addictions and whatnot in my own life. But yeah, and I think there's a degree to which that's necessary. You know, I mean, there are artists out there that I see and hear that, like, this is them. Like, this is authentic. Like, the person that you see on stage is the same person that you get off stage. You know? But then I think it kind of depending on the music or whatever the art form is, if it's, you know, theater or movies or whatever, there's a degree of that too, right? Where you kind of have to put on the mask and put on the costume and then go out there on stage and be like, ha, here I am, you know. It, not out of an identity crisis thing so much, like an imposter syndrome thing, but because, like an actor, like I think there's a degree to which we're all actors too. Musicians are still actors. And I think for me personally, I wish I had that clarity to separate those two and say, well, that the person that I, you know, I put on the tuxedo and I get the big, you know, 3 foot long baton and I'm pretending that I'm Cab Calloway up on the stage in front of a 20 piece big band. That's a persona, that's a character that I'm playing that doesn't need to validate, nor does it need to be in any way connected to the person that I am when I step off stage and I go home. And I think my biggest problem was that they were kind of the same. You know, they were the same person. So, you know, and my wife asks me all the time, because she put up with the worst of it, really. And so she saw me at my worst, and then she has seen my transformation since then. And been very obviously very supportive of that. But she asks me all the time, she was looking, she said, do you miss it? And I know what the subtext of that question is. And I can truly say, no, I do not miss it. And I haven't played a live gig in years. And I have no desire to. But do I feel like I've got the strength and wisdom and clarity around all of that, that if there was an opportunity for me to do so, could I go out there and separate the two? And get up on stage and be whatever persona was needed for that moment, and then step back up and just stay exactly who I am right now? Yeah, probably. I'm not willing to test it yet, but I think I probably could.
So, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah, no, thanks. I always think of Vimalakirti, you know, when I think about, you know, that keeping those things kind of separate. It's like, oh, this is my job and my household, and there's a spiritual person over here, and it's like, yeah, that's just what I do, you know.
Excellent role model.
Living in the world, but not of it, I guess.
Yeah,
exactly. Something to aspire to. Yeah.
I like your metal stuff too. You sound great. Rock on. Splinter Drone, baby.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Really, I've been listening to it. It's good stuff.
Really. Thank you. Stuff. Thank you.
I told Lisa, we actually played a gig together many years ago. She didn't remember. I did, though.
That with Kathy Walker.
Yeah, Kathy Walker Band. Yeah. Hood to Coast Relay, the finish line of Hood to Coast. Yeah. That was a fun show. Long show, 5 hours, I think, something like that. It was crazy. All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Questions, comments? I think we've just got maybe time for one. Betty. Hi, Betty. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Thanks for the talk. You mentioned that you did some studying with the Thai Forest group in the Gorge. Is that right?
The Hermitage is in the Gorge, and the Hermitage is a subdivision of Abayagiri Monastery in Northern California. And then the local community here in Portland that supports the Hermitage and the monastery is Portland Friends of the Dhamma.
Oh, got it.
Yeah,
it's an interesting concept. Yeah. The Hermitage. You know, And I'm just curious about your impression of how their beliefs and practices fit into the relief of suffering of others part of Buddhism.
Yeah, I think this was why I gravitated more towards Zen, where the Bodhisattva ideal appeals to me personally a little bit more. I think in that tradition, and I'm just speaking from my own perception, it has nothing to do with anybody else, but the monastics are role models. You know, mm-hmm. we aspire to learn from them and not imitate them, but to a certain degree, you know, adopt little bits and pieces of what they do for ourselves. And that's supposed to get, that's our sense of purpose. But, you know, to be perfectly frank, one of the things that I started to get a little sideways about was, it's like these guys are like, and you can hear it, like some of the guys that have been monks for, you know, 25, 30 years, they'll give a talk and they're relating their struggles with delusion. They're relating it to things that happen in the monastery on a daily basis. I'm going, I can't personally relate to that. I've got a regular life. And so there's always been for me a little bit of a disconnect between what's relevant for you as a, you know, the abbot of a monastery for 30 odd years, that's completely cloistered, versus me as a regular run of the mill person, you know? So there's kind of a harder line of separation between the monastics and the lay people than I find in Zen, where it's a little more of a crossover. Plus in Zen, there's so much of a focus on the Bodhisattva ideal that, you know, we're trying to enlighten others, right? We're delaying our enlightenment until all others are enlightened. And in that tradition, it's very much about your own individual enlightenment, achieving nirvana as quickly as you can, whether it's in this life or in a future life. So I was, you know, that put me off a little bit, but it's a wonderful community. Friends of the Dhamma is wonderful. And the teachings are great. You know, they base all of them on the original Pali Canon and whatnot. So there's a lot of really good stuff there. And I was really grateful for the time I spent with them.
Thank you.
All right, I think we are at time, yeah? So, look like there are any other questions, so we'll do our closing. Abiding in this ephemeral life like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, all Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna, Paramita.